Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. Democracy Now!
During the operation, we will intensify the military control in the Gaza Strip by segmenting the strip and relocating the population for their own protection. In all areas, we'll operate.
The Israeli military issues expulsion orders for Palestinians in Gaza's second largest city of Khan Yunis and intensifies its bombardment, killing hundreds over the weekend, including at least five journalists. We'll get an update. Then the group behind Project 2025 has a plan to crush the pro-Palestinian movement. We'll speak with New York Times investigative reporter Katie J.M. Baker about the Heritage Foundation's Project Esther.
Project Esther uses terms HSN Hamas Support Network and HSO Hamas Support Organization to rebrand what they call the so-called pro-Palestinian movement. That includes groups that have organized pro-Palestinian protests, such as Jewish Voice for Peace.
And today would have been the 100th birthday of civil rights icon Malcolm X.
To bring about the complete independence of people of African descent here in the Western Hemisphere and first here in the United States, and bring about the freedom of these people by any means necessary.
We'll speak with Malcolm X's daughter, Dr. Ilyasa Shabazz, about his legacy, and with civil rights attorney Ben Crump about the family's lawsuit to release all files about Malcolm X's assassination. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's escalating its war on Gaza, killing hundreds of Palestinians over the weekend, including at least five journalists. On Sunday, Israel killed at least 160 Palestinians, including 36 people in the Al-Mawasi area, where Israeli warplanes bombed a tent camp housing displaced people. Multiple hospitals have also come under attack. Earlier today, Israel ordered the forced evacuation of Khan Yunis, Gaza's second-largest city. On Sunday, Israel announced the start of what it called a new extensive ground operation in Gaza, named Operation Gideon's Chariots. The prominent Israeli reporter, Gideon Levy, said a more apt name for the offensive would be, quote, chariots of genocide, unquote. Residents in Jabalia say Israel's attacks have been relentless.
They're bombing houses and the people got scared. What should we do? This is the reality of the occupier. What can I say? They treat us as if we are animals, not as humans. It was an extremely terrifying night. Many people were killed and many were wounded. It's a savage army, despicable Zionists. They do not treat us as human beings. It was a horrific night. Children and women torn to pieces, hundreds of houses bombed. And as you can see, this is why we are going.
On Sunday, Israel announced it would begin allowing what it called a basic amount of food into Gaza, following an 11-week blockade on all food, aid and medicine. Last week, a key hunger monitor warned 1 in 5 Palestinians in Gaza are facing starvation. In more news on Gaza, NBC News reports the Trump administration's working on a plan to permanently remove 1 million Palestinians from Gaza and transfer them to Libya. On Friday, UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk said Israel's actions in Gaza are, quote, tantamount to ethnic cleansing, unquote. On Sunday, a group of Italian lawmakers took part in a protest on the Egyptian side of the Rafah border with Gaza. This is Laura Boldrini, the former speaker in the Italian parliament's lower chamber.
We are here to break the silence on what's happening in Gaza, the extermination of the Palestinian people. We cannot accept what's happening there.
Major Palestinian solidarity protests were held this weekend in London and The Hague, where as many as 100,000 protesters, many wearing the color red, called on the Dutch government to draw a red line and stop supporting Israel. Former President Joe Biden has been diagnosed with aggressive prostate cancer just months after leaving the White House. On Sunday, his office said the cancer had spread to his bones. In a statement, Biden's office said, quote, "While this represents a more aggressive form of the disease, the cancer appears to be hormone sensitive, which allows for effective management," unquote. Biden is 82 years old. The diagnosis comes amidst growing scrutiny of former White House aides accused of concealing Biden's deteriorating health in recent years. On Tuesday, CNN journalists Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson are publishing a book on the issue titled Original Sin, President Biden's Decline, Its Cover-Up, and His Disastrous Choice to Run Again. On Sunday, the House Budget Committee passed a bill to give tax breaks to the rich while slashing funding for Medicaid, food stamps and subsidies for clean energy. One estimate shows nearly 14 million people could lose health coverage under the plan. In an earlier vote on Friday, a group of far-right Republicans rejected the bill because they sought even bigger cuts. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut appeared on NBC's Meet the Press Sunday.
Well, what we're standing in the way of is the most massive transfer of wealth from the poor and the middle class to the rich in the history of the country. This budget bill is an absolute disaster. It is going to kick over 10 million people off of their health care. Medicaid covers about a quarter of all Americans. In order to pass along a new $1 trillion tax cut for the richest 1%, nobody in this country is asking for that.
On Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court blocked President Trump from using the 1798 Alien Enemies Act to expel a group of Venezuelans detained in Texas. The justices said that detained individuals are entitled to, quote, constitutionally adequate notice prior to any removal, unquote. In related news, the director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, has fired two top officials who authored a report that determined the Venezuelan government is not directly backing the Tren de Aragua gang. The report contradicted a key part of Trump's rationale to invoke the Alien Enemies Act. Meanwhile, Friday, dozens of demonstrators rallied outside a Maryland federal courthouse demanding the return of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, the Maryland father who was mistakenly sent to a mega prison in El Salvador. Ama Frimipong is a legal director at CASA.
What is happening to Kilmer is all part of Trump and the administration's bigger strategy to erase black and brown people from this country and inch us closer and closer to white supremacy.
New disclosure forms show U.S. Attorney Pam Bondi sold between $1 million and $5 million worth of shares of President's Trump Media Company on April 2nd, the same day Trump unveiled his plan for sweeping global tariffs leading to stock prices plummeting. He called it Liberation Day. In California, FBI officials have identified the suspect in the bombing of a Palm Springs fertility clinic Saturday as 25-year-old local resident Guy Edward Bartkus.
The subject had nihilistic ideations, and this was a targeted attack against the IDF facility. Make no mistake, we are treating this, as I said yesterday, as an intentional act of terrorism.
Investigators believe the suspect, who may have belonged to a fringe online community that promotes antinatalism or the creation of new life, died in the attack. Four others were injured. President Trump is set to speak with Russian President Vladimir Putin today. In a post online, Trump said the call focused on stopping what he called the bloodbath in Ukraine. Trump's also expected to speak with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Last week, Ukrainian and Russian officials held talks in Turkey, but the fighting continued over the weekend, with Ukraine accusing Russia of carrying out its largest drone attack of the war. Meanwhile, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Bridget Brink, who resigned in April, has publicly criticized Trump's policies, writing, quote, "The policy since the beginning of the Trump administration has been to put pressure on the victim, Ukraine, rather than on the aggressor, Russia," unquote. Meanwhile, at the Vatican, Pope Leo, repeated his call for peace in Gaza and Ukraine and met with Zelensky on Sunday. Earlier today, the Pope also held a meeting with Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio. In Romania, the centrist Bucharest mayor, Nicos Dan, has defeated his far-right rival, George Simion. The election came almost 5 months after Romania's constitutional court annulled the 2024 presidential election won by the far-right ultra-nationalist Ceilan Georgescu, who was then barred from running again. Meanwhile, in Portugal, the ruling center-right Democratic Alliance has won a snap election but fell short of a majority. The far-right party Chega surged, winning a record 22% of the vote. The chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, Karim Khan, has stepped down temporarily after staffers at the ICC accused him of sexual abuse and retaliation. Khan has denied the allegations. He made international headlines a year ago this week when he announced he was seeking war crimes charges against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and ex-defense minister Yoav Gallant, as well as two leaders from Hamas. Meanwhile, the Associated Press reports U.S. sanctions are hampering the ICC's work. Microsoft disabled Khan's email account. His bank accounts were frozen. Americans working with the ICC fear they will be arrested if they return to the United States. One of the most prominent anti-corruption lawyers in El Salvador was arrested Sunday night. Ruth Lopez is the head of the Anti-Corruption Justice Unit at Cristosal, a leading Salvadoran human rights group that has frequently criticized the policies of the Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele. Last year, the BBC named Ruth Lopez one of the 100 most influential women in the world. A new UN-backed study has found global hunger reached a new high last year, with more than 295 million people facing acute hunger. That's twice the total from 2020. A leading driver of global hunger has been war and conflict. Acute hunger has soared in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Haiti, the Sudan, South Sudan, Burma, and Palestine. A hunger-striking student at UCLA was hospitalized Sunday on the ninth day of her action. Maya Abdullah is one of a growing group of students at universities across the United States who've launched hunger strikes amidst the Israeli blockade on Gaza to demand their schools divest from Israel and protect free speech on campus. Hunger strikes are ongoing at Yale, Stanford, and at California State University schools. In the nation's capital, a recent graduate of George Washington University delivered a blistering commencement speech in front of a roaring crowd.
I cannot celebrate my own graduation without a heavy heart, knowing how many students in Palestine have been forced to stop their studies, expelled from their homes, and killed for simply remaining in the country of their ancestors.
That was George Washington University graduate Cecilia Culver. She called on fellow graduates to withhold donations until GWU discloses and divests from Israel. Here in New York, the wife and newborn child of abducted Columbia graduate Mahmoud Khalil accepted a diploma on Khalil's behalf during an alternative graduation ceremony held by the People's University for Palestine. This is Dr. Noor Abdullah, who gave birth to the couple's first child, Dean, last month while Mahmoud was in custody.
Every day since Dean was born, I understand more and more why the struggle matters. I hope he grows up to be as brave as his father and as brave as every single student here who has risked so much. Your education, your safety, even your futures to speak up for Palestine. Today we honor not only Mahmoud, but all of the students who were wrongfully expelled and suspended for standing up in support of Palestinian rights.
Columbia University students are graduating this week. A whistleblower reported last week the Department of Homeland Security's Civil Rights Division had just opened a probe into Mahmoud Khalil's arrest when President Trump moved to dissolve the office in March, putting officials on leave and halting ongoing investigations. At least 28 people died after powerful tornadoes swept through Missouri and Kentucky. The National Weather Service had to scramble to find forecasters to track the storm around the clock after the Trump administration eliminated a permanent overnight forecaster in Jackson, Kentucky. In labor news, a three-day New Jersey transit strike has ended after a tentative deal was reached to give train engineers a pay raise. Train service is expected to resume on Tuesday. New Jersey Transit is the third largest commuter rail in the country. And in New York, a Mexican Navy ship crashed into the Brooklyn Bridge Saturday. Two crew members died. Two dozen others were injured when the ship's three masts broke off after hitting the underside of the Brooklyn Bridge. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Gaza. Palestinians are fleeing Khan Yunis, the besieged territory's second largest city, after the Israeli military issued expulsion orders. This comes as Israel's bombardment of Gaza continues, killing hundreds of Palestinians over the weekend, including at least five journalists. Health facilities have been under constant attack. On Sunday, Israel announced Operation Gideon's Chariots, what it called a new extensive ground operation in Gaza. The prominent Israeli columnist Gideon Levy said a more apt name for the offensive would be, quote, chariots of genocide, unquote. The Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, said Sunday Israel would allow limited food supplies into Gaza as the population of more than 2 million faces famine after 11 weeks of a total Israeli blockade. But it's not clear exactly when that food will cross the border. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres once again decried the catastrophic situation in Gaza and the utter failure of the international community to stop Israel.
In Gaza, the situation of Palestinians is beyond description, beyond atrocious, and beyond inhumane. The policy of siege and starvation makes a mockery of international law.
NBC News reports the Trump administration's working on a plan to permanently remove 1 million Palestinians from Gaza and transfer them to Libya. On Friday, UN human rights chief Volker Turk said Israel's actions in Gaza are, quote, tantamount to ethnic cleansing. Gaza's health ministry confirms Israel's killed at least 53,300 Palestinians in Gaza since October 2023. The death toll does not account for thousands of people believed dead, including those trapped under the rubble, nor those killed by the indirect effects of Israel's assault on Gaza. In fact, the number could be more than two times, three times higher. For more, we're joined in Montreal by Muin Rabbani, Middle East analyst, co-editor of Jadalia, and a non-resident fellow at the Center for Conflict and Humanitarian Studies. He's a contributor to the book Deluge, Gaza and Israel, From Crisis to Cataclysm. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Muin. Thanks so much for being with us. If you can respond to the situation right now, the escalation of the attacks on Gaza.
Well, the situation, as anyone who's following the news can see, is thoroughly apocalyptic. There is not only an unprecedented siege, but also an unprecedented intensification of Israel's genocidal military campaign in the Gaza Strip. And judging by the statements of Israel's most senior leaders, it aims towards the complete occupation of the Gaza Strip and the destruction of everything that remains standing in the Gaza Strip, and ultimately the mass forcible expulsion of its entire population. And the past few days have been particularly cataclysmic. At the same time, negotiations about a potential new agreement are ongoing, and this will be decided neither by Israel nor by the Palestinians, but by the United States. To the extent that Israel continues with this assault, it means that it has a U.S. green light for doing so. To the extent that the situation changes, that means that Israel has been instructed by Washington to change course.
Talk about Israel partially lifting the blockade. What exactly does this mean after 11 months of a full blockade on medicine and aid? 11 weeks.
At this stage, it doesn't appear to mean very much. According to reports available this morning, Israel is preparing to permit something on the order of 50 trucks to enter the Gaza Strip. And we're talking about a population of between 1.5 and 2 million people who have been deprived of any goods entering from outside the territory since the very beginning of March. So this is clearly a drop in the bucket. I think the more important question is whether this is the beginning of a lifting of the siege under U.S. and international pressure, and just as importantly, whether Israel and the U.S. are going to move ahead with this harebrained scheme that has already been denounced by the international aid community of setting up a aid mechanism whose purpose is to force the relocation of the Gaza Strip population to specified locations where they can access limited humanitarian supplies under the watchful eye of U.S. mercenaries acting on behalf of the Israeli military and government.
Can you talk about the U.S. plan that's been reported to move Palestinians to Libya?
Yes, it's interesting that this report has now been formally denied by the U.S. embassy in Libya. I think as a precautionary measure, given what happened to that embassy about a decade ago. But we do know that President Trump has repeatedly proposed an initiative whereby the entire Palestinian population of the Gaza Strip would be forcibly relocated outside the Gaza Strip. It would be taken over and rebuilt, presumably by U.S. real estate developers acting in coordination with Israel. And there have been persistent reports that the U.S. and Israel have been approaching a variety of countries, both within the region and beyond, to accept these forcibly displaced Palestinians. And in respect of Libya, the reports are that the U.S. has offered Libya to unfreeze billions of dollars in Libyan funds that have been frozen in international financial institutions since the reign of Muammar Gaddafi, who was overthrown and killed over a decade ago, if and only if Libya accepts 1 million Palestinians on its territory. This would increase the Libyan population by over 10%, and it's effectively bribing Libya with its own money to participate in this war crime and crime against humanity. But it seems to me exceptionally unlikely that Libya will even seriously consider this proposal for one moment, given the impact it would have on Libya's domestic politics, which is very strongly pro-Palestinian. And I think the real issue here is not the extent to which this initiative can actually be implemented, but rather the legitimization it gives to Israel's determination repeatedly expressed to expel the Palestinian population of the Gaza Strip and further down the line from the West Bank as well.
On Friday, President Trump actually said, quote, "A lot of people are starving in Gaza under the Israeli blockade." He said the U.S. wanted to help reduce the suffering. What can the U.S. do? What can the world do? You have up to 100,000 people in the Netherlands protesting outside The Hague. You have a number of Italian parliament members going to the Egyptian side of the Rafah border, demanding that the world stop arming Israel. Can you talk about what the solutions are at this point?
Well, you had, as you mentioned, the 100,000 approximately protesters in the Netherlands, with reports of something in the range of 500,000 in London the day before. And there is growing opposition and disgust with Israel's engineered starvation policy and absolutely genocidal military campaign in the Gaza Strip. And A number of European governments are now beginning to speak more loudly as well, calling, for example, for a reconsideration of Israel's preferential trade privileges with the European Union. But at this stage, the decision really will be made not in London or Brussels or Berlin, but in Washington, because of the extraordinary leverage that the United States exercises over Israel. And it will take no more than a phone call from Washington to the Israeli government to effect a complete reversal in Israeli policy within the space of a day. That's really the only reason we're now seeing this limited, very limited resumption of aid. And with respect to the statements by President Trump, I think we also need to bear in mind we're dealing here with a quite erratic leader who can contradict himself in the space of a day or even an hour. So what we really need to focus is not so much on what he says, but what the United States does. There are ongoing negotiations for a new agreement, and it's difficult to tell exactly what's happening there. Of course, they're being held behind closed doors, but we still need to find out the extent to which Washington is exercising genuine pressure, if any, on Israel to force it to accept an agreement that will lift the siege, lead to an exchange of captives, and ultimately put an end to this genocidal war.
Let me ask you, finally, DropSite News is reporting a senior Hamas official received assurances from President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, the U.S. would force Israel to lift the Gaza blockade within 2 days after releasing the U.S. Israeli citizen, Edan Alexander. Bassem Naim, a member of Hamas's political bureau, said the Trump administration reneged on its promise, saying they didn't violate the deal. They threw it in the trash. Your response to the report, and if you think that's why they lifted, Israel lifted it partially?
Well, these reports may well form part of the background of today's developments that we've been discussing. But at the time, it was, Hamas said it was releasing this Israeli soldier, who's also a U.S. Citizen, as a goodwill gesture on the eve of Trump's visit to the Middle East. And the Americans also said they had offered nothing in exchange. So quite clearly, there were no formal undertakings by the United States, but I think it's entirely reasonable to suppose that there were informal assurances given. And those, once again, ended up not being worth the paper they were, or in this case, were not written on. But at the same time, they could form part of the background of the developments that we're seeing now, which is that negotiations seem to have been intensified. I think it's very premature to conclude that they will succeed or result in a meaningful agreement, but there's quite clearly more going on behind the scenes than we are directly aware of.
Mouin Rabbani, I want to thank you for being with us, Middle East analyst, co-editor of Jadalia, and a non-resident fellow at the Center for Conflict and Humanitarian Studies, contributor to the book Deluge, speaking to us from Montreal, Canada. When we come back, the group behind Project 2025 has a plan to crush the pro-Palestinian movement. We'll speak with New York Times investigative reporter Katie J.M. Baker about the Heritage Foundation's Project Esther. Stay with us. The Tunisian singer performing last night at the People's Graduation for Columbia students in honor of the Palestinian activist Mahmoud Khalil, who is supposed to graduate from Columbia's SIPA school, the School of International and Public Affairs. Instead, he's imprisoned in an immigration jail in Louisiana. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We turn now to a new report in the New York Times that takes a deep dive into Project Esther, a policy blueprint from the far-right Heritage Foundation, best known for creating Project 2025. Project Esther was launched October 7, 2024, and lays out plans for surveilling, silencing, and punishing